It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. We've got John Birdsall with us once again. This is Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear and John Birdsall. How you doing, John?
With Kirk and John. With Kirk and John. Remember that.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm doing really well. How are you?
Awesome. Hey, you know, some of our listeners might like to know things that we do in our
private lives. I find that hard to believe, but go ahead.
People ask once in a while.
Okay.
But
all right.
This is a semi-private thing, but I thought you might like to give a shout-out about your benefit that you ran earlier this week.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm very impressed with your philanthropy, by the way.
Well, you know what? It's an annual fundraiser for the Milwaukee Rescue Mission, and this is the fifth year I've done it. And really, this is how I got involved in it, is that I was obviously working in town and an attorney and whatnot, but I always felt like there was a lot more to do, you know, like we run our businesses and whatnot. But then I read this article about this attorney who worked with guys over at the Milwaukee Rescue Mission. Now, there's actually guys that live at the mission. They sign a contract. They live there for a year. They get clean. They get educated. They get a job, you know, and then they go out and, you know, fix their lives. Well, you know, they all have problems like warrants and child support, unpaid taxes, you know, whatever it is, they all have legal problems. And so I joined this guy as a volunteer he was sort of semi-retired, and I did that about 8 years ago. And, you know, and a few years after I was doing it regularly, I decided I should have a fundraiser. So, that's what's going on. Yeah. And,
awesome.
And it's a huge problem, obviously nationally, but also in Milwaukee. I mean, can you imagine sleeping outdoors? Imagine sleeping outdoors in the middle of winter in Wisconsin.
Or Wisconsin winters. Yeah, I know.
Oh, how
that's
horrible.
Definitely a problem. Well, why is it important to you in particular? I mean, I'm with you, but why?
Well, I think that I don't know. I just, you know, and I'm not like a real touchy feely sort of guy, but
you're not
I'm not a bleeding heart, but I do think that all of us, lawyers or whoever, we have a duty, I think, to give back to our community as much as we can do that, you know. And this is a no-brainer, you know. People without homes, I mean, and however they got there, you know, whether it's, and most of them got there just through, you know, drug use or just
mental
circumstances, mental health problems, you know. And you can't, you know, I'm never going to solve everybody's problem. That's just not my intent. My intent is to do as much as I can, you know, for as many as I can. And then, you know, and hopefully it impacts some people's lives. I consider it a duty of mine, you know. So it's sort of like some cases I take from the public defender's office where you're basically working for free, you know, on the $40 thing. You know,
right.
I just feel a duty to do that once in a while.
Very good. I'm impressed.
And I appreciate your participation and assistance in that endeavor, yeah. Kirk. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, you're very welcome. Hey, another thing. We both presented at a seminar last week.
A seminar that you put together.
Yeah, that I put together for criminal defense lawyers. And this one was a particularly interesting one because we brought in experts from various fields, including computer science, polygraphy, and
not Big Love,
DNA, yeah, Big Love, and also Title IX type cases, which are becoming more and more prevalent. Have you ever handled a Title IX case?
I have.
Oh, yeah. I just started doing them more frequently, but just so our listeners understand, that's basically since 2010, a law that had been in existence since the 1970s that required any school, public or private, that receives federal funding has to take proactive measures to make sure that people are not discriminated against on the basis of gender, race, etc. And there was a memorandum that came from the executive branch of some enforcement agency, I don't remember which one actually, well, Department of Education, right, that handles this whole thing, said that, by the way, this law, in our opinion, expands to cover things like sexual assault. Not just sexual harassment, but sexual assault.
Yeah.
And all the universities, colleges, et cetera, high schools throughout the country then had to establish basically a Title IX processing unit within
which their most of them don't know what they're doing at all.
Right, right. So this is kind of it's a relatively new area of law in the sense that it never used to encompass an internal, you know, administrative investigation into these types of things. And certainly lawyers didn't get involved until really within the past, I'd say 3 years has been it's reaching a pinnacle point where there is actually a lot of activity that goes on. Now, I've handled several of these. It's really picked up for me in the past several years. And you know, it's kind of tragic in the sense that no one wins in these things.
I agree with that.
Administrative forum where it's a quasi-judicial, and I quasi in capital letters.
Very, very quasi, yeah.
Yeah, and almost invariably, regardless of who's telling the truth, who's lying, who was drinking, whatever, you know, it results in the alleged perpetrator being dismissed from the college almost always. I mean, there's got to be.
Actually, I've had large success both with sexual assault allegations in different schools, and but the frustrating part was that the investigative process.
Yeah.
Almost completely cuts the lawyer out. I mean, you're allowed to have an attorney, but you're not allowed to participate. And they largely ignore you
right at the beginning. Just you know, you're here to be quiet. but also, you know, another thing is that you don't get complete access to the investigative file.
True.
You know, you can rebut things, but you don't know exactly what you're rebutting. And once in a while, you'll get an investigator, quote unquote, has a sense of fairness in this process, but that is very heavily weighed against by the fact that the university is trying to protect itself from liability almost always. I say that, you know, I've had success as well in cases where there was an ability to present factual information that was reliable. But the problem is, and I've had others, and this is just the unfortunate thing about it, where if you're truly applying a preponderance of the evidence standard, which is very difficult to define, all we know about it is that it's, what does my friend Chad Lanning say, 50% and a feather. That's what he says. But it's we do know it's below proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We know it's more than, you know, less than a preponderance. But otherwise, you can't convert these things into a mathematical equation. And it's never been designed to be run by actual judges or lawyers. Not to say that, you know, that's necessarily a problem, because I don't think every university, college, and high school could employ, you know, an administrative law judge to preside over these things. But
well,
there is a sense of – anyway, the point is this. You know, talk about a witch hunt. This is like the Salem witch trials all over again.
Yeah, you know, the problem is that they have no training in the law or legal process, and their concerns are not for a fair and balanced approach. Their concerns are for their institution.
Yeah. Now, you know? Let's balance that with the fact that there have been successful lawsuits from, you know, respondents or, you know, what's the correct term? You know, an appellant of this process. Mm-hmm. That can, if you can allege that there was irreparable harm done to the accused, so to speak, the university can be liable for that too. So there has been some civil action taken in that regard, and some of them have made headlines. Anyway, this seminar was very well received, and I wanted to tell you, since I didn't really have a chance to catch up with you afterwards, that your presentation in particular was extraordinarily well received.
Oh, that's nice.
And another thing, I don't know if you got to see Brett Caney's presentation.
I did not.
Because you had to run. But he's an associate at my office, and this was his first CLE presentation. and he just wowed the crowd with his
hit it out
voice.
Of the park.
He hit it out of the park. It was more beautiful. Than a grand slam. I mean, everybody walked away from this thing energized, ready to go, ready to fight the fight.
Well, give me the cliff notes on that. I wasn't there.
Okay. Absolutely, I will.
No. Like right now. Like just
oh, right now. Well, we're coming up on a break, but I'll give you okay. a start. Basically, okay. You know, Brett had one of these cases, he and I did it together. But it was an allegation of possession of child pornography. And we all know that those cases are
very hard,
very difficult to defend.
Very, very hard.
And what we'll do is we'll take a break right now, listen to some sponsor messages, and then I'll continue with the story.
Love those sponsors.
Love the sponsors. They're what float the boat, man. So, all right. We'll be right back after these messages.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back. It's Legal Defense with Kirk and John. And, you know, someday we'll make it John and Kirk, but right now it's Kirk and John.
Wait a minute,
he says. I'm just kidding. So, anyways, you were regaling us with Brett's presentation at the CLE that you put together.
Yeah, so here's the thing. Possession of child pornography is one of those areas that we all, you know, people cringe when they hear about it and they think, you know, that kind of thing. So generally speaking,
it is kind of icky to think about, but you know,
it is, of course. I mean, and it should be, why not? I mean, the laws against this stuff are there for a reason, but just a little bit of background because the laws that make them very, very severe are philosophically, the rationale behind them are twofold. One is obvious, which is that it's gross, okay? And that, you know, if we want to declare something contraband because it's bad, obviously the law has the ability to do that. But secondly, when it's a problem that's not exactly been obviated by circumstances but has been lessened by virtue of technology. And if you look back at when the very strict and harsh child pornography laws were initially created, in fact, there are many examples of cases where somebody received a higher sentence for possessing a picture or movie of a sexual act that the person did not participate in but merely possessed that, you know, pictographic representation.
Than an actual contact event.
Then if they had actually had the contact with the child.
As an aside, there's extensive research now that says that people who just view images are almost never become contact offenders.
Right.
Virtually
so that's
unheard
part of. And that's really goes back to the first rationale is that it's gross. We want to – if it says something about a person's sexual proclivities, whatever, you know, that's something bad. You know, and if we add some statistics to that, it may not bear itself out. But here's the other aspect of it. Back in the early days of interest, where if you want to call it that, in child pornography, those that would seek to possess it – the actual contraband itself, in other words, the images, were much rarer and had monetary value. And that sounds really gross, but it's true. In other words, it was something that was sold, traded, you know, and bought for money. And that it was perceived, and probably correctly so back at the time, that anyone who possessed such an image would be feeding into the market of those that would have an incentive to create it. Taking it one step further, those that have an incentive, a monetary incentive to create it, would also have that incentive to abduct children and force them to commit sexual acts, etc.
I see the dots getting connected there, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the logic, and it made sense at one point in time. The problem is
file sharing.
Now, file sharing is something where, you know, I have not seen a case where somebody allegedly paid for child pornography in a very long time, with the exception being the general exception being there are certain paid sites where people can subscribe and get access to it. But because of the fact that it's illegal and the people know that it's illegal, the general way of distributing this, it merely becomes a matter of file sharing. And that's done almost nowadays. Almost every case I have seen, at least in recent years, has been through the process of a program like LimeWire, FrostWire.
Peer-to-peer file sharing,
Peer-to-peer file sharing. So anyway, it's kind of changed how the investigations have gone in the sense that it's become much easier for law enforcement to simply,
all they have to do is peek into your shared folder. It's pretty easy.
Right. Yeah, and since the way that those programs work, you're, whether you realize it or not, you have an open invitation for people to look at what you have. That's how they work. But anyway, getting back to Brett's presentation, we had a case where it was not your typical, you know, guy was collecting child pornography for his own kicks. It wasn't that kind of case at all. They found child pornography in the typical method, which is examining through a peer-to-peer network. And this individual, by the way, did give our office consent to talk about it.
Okay.
You know, there's no problem here. I'm not going to name names, obviously, but there was such a variety of issues that came up. First of all, many of the images that were charged, and this was a bit of a stretch in my opinion, were not, in fact, part of the national database that keeps track of known contraband images. So we had the whole issue of can you prove how old the person is? And we did some very extensive, with the aid of an expert, research to affirmatively prove to the jury that many of these images were ones that were, I think one image in particular was found to have been available on 97 different adult legal websites.
Oh, yeah?
And in fact, we tracked down the quote-unquote actress that was on several of these images who had her own webpage and advertised herself as a model available for pornographic participation, etc. And granted, she looked very young, but according to her own bio, she was 23. So we had some resistance from the judge in terms of whether that information could be admitted and what kind of foundation would have to be laid and arguments over whether what you see on the internet is true or not and those kinds of things. But anyway, it led to the dismissal of several charges pretrial and then, acquittals on various others.
Acquittals based on the argument that, ladies and gentlemen.
Other things as well. But we had a jury that was willing to, consider the true, the actual burden of proof and what the state had proven. Now, getting to that point where you get past the ick factor and the jury's really willing to give this a serious look is the biggest challenge in those cases. Now, what Brett did is that he gave this, I can say, nothing short of an inspirational lecture on having the guts to stand up for what you believe in and taking that case to trial when you know there's no other option. Because convincing a prosecutor that your position is correct is a very arduous task.
And, yeah.
Frankly, when it comes down to...
Laugh you right out of the room.
Right, exactly. So, that... taking that case before the jury, having the jury see the images. Oh, I mean, the thought is something that makes us all, sort of quiver. But here's another thing that came up in this case, and I've seen this a lot. The images that they found were thumbnails. They never found
full-size
pictures.
So they blew them up?
So that was an issue in the case, is that when thumbnails are downloaded, the other thing is, they found 128 thumbnails, something like that, that had been downloaded in the span of 3.5 seconds. And the theory was that that's enough That's you know. But what you can tell happened here with the use of our expert is that they may have been downloaded, they may have been possessed, but there's no evidence that the person actually viewed. And there was a problem with the way that the computer data referenced. There was missing information that they could not extract from the hard drive involved. That they basically couldn't show that there was a deliberate effort to view. So
there was no searches and that sort of data?
Well, there was, and that was another problem in the case. But and that's, I believe, why he got convicted of some counts, but not all. Anyway, an interesting aspect of this is that the prosecution, of course, wanted to have gigantic, blown-up versions of these images.
Oh, I hope you won that battle.
Yeah, actually. Because our argument was it should be in the same size and the same actual – if they're alleging that this is what was downloaded and it's something that is not microscopic but very small, you know, that should be the manner in which it's presented to the jury. I mean, it could be on a monitor. It could be on a piece of paper. But it should not be enlarged, you know, to an 8 foot by 11 foot.
Yeah, because it misrepresents what the actual evidence is.
Exactly. And their argument was, well, you know, it's difficult to see what it is when it's in its original format. We're like, exactly.
Well, that's kind of our point. Thank you for making it. Yes.
So, you know, a lot of people that were in the audience had handled cases. A few had taken them to trial, but the majority of the attendees were, you know, these are cases that you do your best to try and deal with the mandatory minimum problem that occurs in these types of things. And it just, you know, the prosecution has a great deal.
Well, that's
of
one of the
power.
Reasons. That's one of the reasons to take these cases to trial is, and I had one just earlier this year where I really didn't have like a solid defense. I mean, I had a somewhat defense because he was downloading a ton of music, and the argument was that this came in as sort of attached to some of this stuff, but I couldn't really connect the dots there. But, you know, it probably would have settled on a probationary basis, but for the mandatory minimums.
Right.
You know?
Okay, time for a break, and we'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. Hey, we left off I'm just going to finish the story real quickly about Brett Kaney's outstanding performance. Anyway.
Yeah, it's like a Brett infomercial.
It is. Sorry. But hey, he's my he's my associate.
He's a very talented lawyer.
So the thing that, and I've always been impressed by this, when this dude gets up and addresses an audience, I mean, in trial and particularly in the CLE thing, I mean, he just has such command over his voice, control over the information, persuasive. I mean, it's like one of those Jerry Spence moments where you're just like, wow. So people came up afterwards and like, oh my God, you are so lucky to have this guy as part of your firm. And they want him to speak again and all this other stuff. So anyway, that was just my little shout out to Brett there. I'm sure he appreciates it. But, you know, you raised an interesting issue that I had one of those philosophical epiphanies earlier this week. Because, you know, when I was preparing when I was preparing for the seminar, I kind of work with each of the presenters to make sure that we don't have a whole lot of overlap on issues and that people have an understanding as to what I'm expecting in terms of written materials, presentation, the depth, kind of thing. And I didn't, of course, you've presented many times, so I didn't have to really coach you. But some of the people that were at this thing were folks that were not
newbies.
Lawyers. And
that's right.
Civilians.
Yes, non-lawyers, right.
Civilians. Yep. And, you know, it sparked a lot of discussion about, you know, what the real gist of all this should be. And it's just ironic timing because, you know, just earlier this week, the report to the president from the, I know I'm going to get this wrong, but the Forensic Science Commission, whatever it's called, it's part of It's a congressional committee. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The report to the president, which is very lengthy, I haven't even finished reading it yet. In fact, I want to devote an entire show where you and I can kind of go through it and talk about the have you looked at it yet at all?
I glanced, but not
I only had time to glance because it was just a few days ago that it came out, and it's saved on a PDF on my laptop, and I will be getting to that surely sometime this weekend. But anyway, when we were talking just in general about, you know, all these issues and how really what the problem has become, and these were part of my introductory comments to the whole group, is that, you know, the government has, for all intents and purposes, unlimited resources. I know they're not truly unlimited, but compared to the resources we have, which are resources we have to create through sheer willpower in most cases, and unless you have an absolute indigent client with a judge that understands the philosophy behind Ake versus Oklahoma and other, you know what I'm talking about, problems that you encounter when you need an expert to battle their expert, and most of their experts are career prosecutorial assistants.
Yeah, or who are employed by the government and work for the government and advocate for the government.
And really, if you look at the history of quote-unquote forensics, that term really only came into use when the government started creating its own science so that it could win cases.
Yes, you know? like tool mark examination and hair comparisons and blah, blah, blah.
For that matter, fingerprints.
Fingerprints.
For that matter, fingerprints.
Because which everybody thinks is some sort of gold standard when it's so not.
And, you know, do you know the history behind when fingerprints came into use?
Yes. Yes.
It goes back to the 1800s, and it was just based on some dude's idea that, you know, based upon the features of fingerprints, that it's probable or likely, with no research at all, that there are no two fingerprints that are alike.
Yeah, nobody's ever proved that. Nobody's ever proved that, number one. Number two is no court in the United States that I am aware of has ever made a finding that fingerprint examination is a valid science, is somehow conclusively, you know, has some sort of scientific validity, unless problem, I missed it.
Well, no. And the problem, we have a relatively recent watershed moment in the law here in Wisconsin, and that's the Daubert standard, Daubert versus Merrill Dow Chemicals. But before that, you know, it was the Cole Porter rule, anything goes. And when judges would rule that
– I remember when Cole Porter came and argued that case, yes.
The idea was that judges played virtually no role in keeping something out, and the standard answer was, well, Mr. Defense Counsel or Madam Defense Counsel,
you could just
cross-examine and bring out those weaknesses.
And certainly you can argue and everything, blah, 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 right?
So, okay. And especially when you got, you know, Dr. Fingerprint expert from the state crime lab coming in and saying, in a course, all of the credentials are laid out there, and of course, the qualifications are being bolstered.
Now, just so you can take a look at who really has influence within our system, you know what singular group was responsible for bringing the Daubert standard by statute to Wisconsin?
Oh, I know. The civil lawyers.
Yes,
the plaintiff's lawyers. Correct?
No, actually, the defense lawyers.
Civil defense lawyers, okay.
Yep. They wanted it because they wanted to, like, knock out some of the plaintiff's attorneys using, you know, sketchy science, which, you know,
and that makes sense.
I kind of agree with that, too.
The guy that comes in and reads tea leaves and says, well, based on what I see here, I believe that the defendants are liable, you know.
Well, the problem with the Daubert standard as it's interpreted, you know, and it's a little bit better at the federal level because they're a little more rigorous. But at the state level, you know, they're still letting in all this consistent with stuff in sexual assault cases. Educate the listeners. You know that somebody will come in and they have no scientific basis, no literature, no nothing to back up other than their own quote-unquote experience. In other words, it's really the same standard in different clothing. So it's a little mm-hmm. frustrating to say that, yeah, we have the Daubert standard, but the truth is that you can skate your way around that any which way, and the judges do that, you know, at least the judges that aren't paying attention much.
And that procedure has actually been codified now. So we have the codification of the Daubert standard, but we simultaneously have the codification of the greater latitude rule. So I know we're getting very complex here, but I want to revert now to my philosophical epiphany.
Oh, I'm sorry. I interrupted your epiphany. Sorry.
No, that's okay. You're allowed to. You're part of the show, man. That's why you're here, is to try and throw me off.
To try and link, yeah. Throw you for a loop. I gotcha. All right.
But I just want to take you back to when the Constitution was written. You know, so put on your three-cornered hat. No.
Got it. About to ready to throw some tea out the window here. Go ahead.
But let me just ask you a question, and that is, and this question has to do with federal supremacy and states' rights issues. And when the Constitution was drafted in the 1780s, an issue that existed then, even back then, and persisted for years afterwards was slavery. In fact, it's in the Constitution.
It is baked into the Constitution.
Well, yeah, and one part that people kind of gloss over is the section that talks about the permission of any state in the Union to participate in the slave trade, okay?
Right.
And what we mean is the import, you know, the kidnapping and importation of human beings. But even when the Constitution was written, there was a forecast moratorium on that practice. Okay, so I believe they gave it, you know, was it 20 or 30 years? I'd have to look to be more
up till 1820, I believe it was.
1820, right. So basically a 30-year, almost 40-year moratorium would go into effect. Now, the idea was that they wanted to give those states that wanted to expand their slave trade an opportunity to do so, but at the same time expressing a federal disapproval of the practice and to temper it somewhat, because there had been a lot of moral questioning, especially in England around this time and shortly after our Constitution, England banned slavery altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
The issue here was that there was a resistance to the idea that the federal government should have a particular policy that relates to matters that states, based on their own individual economies, geography, and the individual makeup of their citizens, should be free to create their own primarily moral standards, but also their own criminal laws, their own set of civil laws. And the restraint on all that was designed to be something that was no more restrictive of individual rights than what the federal rights embodied in the Constitution and ultimately the Bill of Rights would protect. So in other words, states are free to do whatever they want as long as it's doesn't run afoul of those protections that are found under federal law. So let's take a quick break, and then I'll continue with my thought process here. Sound good?
All right.
All right. Okay, we'll be right back after these messages.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back. It's Legal Defense with Kirk and John, and we've been spending a great deal of time listening to Kirk's elucidations on various subjects, and so it's hard to take breaks when he's this highly caffeinated. So
my gums are flapping. It's hard.
I'll tell you.
The sponsors are all waiting in the wings. Hey, come on.
Is it Starbucks or some other coffee variation that's got you going this morning?
Oh, it's Pete's Coffee.
Pete's Coffee.
That's my favorite.
Is
Pete's.
It? Okay.
Have you ever tried Pete's?
I don't think so. Is that just a Sheboygan thing or?
No. It's out of California. Matter of fact, they roast. And the day that they're done roasting, it's in the mail to you express. And you've got it, like, you know, it's practically still warm when you get it at your doorstep. But anyway.
you certainly know how to create a picture there, Kirk.
I do. Well, getting back to this issue of federal versus state, you know, laws.
Is this going to tie into the three-fifths clause, too?
No, I'm just talking about the very basic idea as to why that difference was important to begin with. But as we saw over the years, certain categories of law, subject matter law, became federal. And you know what I'm talking about. Some of the big areas that we talk about are, you know, early examples would include, what was it, the Mann Act, or, you know, you can't mm-hmm. transport a minor across state lines, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Something, and then, of course, the Controlled Substances Act, which declared that drugs were enough of a national problem that the federal government had the power to step in and create its own set of controlled substances.
And you know why they had the power? Because they said so.
They said so, right. This is nowhere in the Constitution. They're just like, wait a minute, part of the Commerce Clause.
Right, the Commerce. I'll never forget when I first learned about the Commerce Clause. I'm like, well, yeah. This covers everything, doesn't
everything.
It?
Everything. Yeah, all you got to do is say that it does, and then it will.
Yeah.
But just crazy. For those of you that are not as versed in constitutional law as John and I are, but the idea is that the Commerce Clause, which basically says that that's a federal issue because commerce affects mm-hmm. all states, all territories, and the federal government has the ability to regulate that.
And even in cases where things are occurring within a state, they still say it affects mm-hmm. the Commerce Clause because it affects the market nationally. You know, correct. even if everything, like let's say you have a product or whatever, or let's say it's drugs, you know, you grow them all in the state, you sell them all in the state, it's all used in the state, but it's still part of a national market. So, of course, the Commerce Clause subsumes it.
And it really has to do, pardon the term here, but it's one that's used often, the intercourse between, different parties involved. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that's how piece by piece we see different bits of federal legislation that apply to subject matters that would otherwise be within state law control. And as that federal government power starts expanding into different areas, I mean, the big ones are if somebody robs a bank because of the fact that the bank is insured by the FDIC or otherwise receives federal, you know, backing, that becomes a federal crime because of that federal angle on it. Of course, we already talked about drugs and controlled substances because of the fact that it's a national problem. The federal government says, okay, that we're going to get involved with this. Same thing with guns. A felon in possession of a firearm or someone who illegally – a prohibited person who possesses a firearm or somebody who possesses a prohibited firearm itself, all those fall under federal law because federal law has invoked its own supremacy mm-hmm. over state law on those issues. Mm-hmm. Now, all of these tend to exist concurrently with state law. But here's my issue. If we understand that and we compare this with another separate problem that has now been emerging on a nationwide level, and that is how do we as an American society, not on necessarily on a state-by-state basis, prevent wrongful convictions? Because you and I are part of the battle to try and improve and strengthen the justice system on a regular basis.
True.
Problem is,
daily,
we're doing this when you tackle one county court or one municipal court or another piece of the many jurisdictions that make up our state. And when you go down to if you practice in Minnesota or Michigan or Illinois or whatever, and then you compare that with what other people are doing in different states, the victories are small and isolated, and the defeats are small and isolated. And there's really no way to have a comprehensive reform of criminal justice. And isn't it true that if we viewed this as a national problem, in other words, the fact that nationwide we have had thousands upon thousands of exonerations that nobody thought was even possible 20 years ago, and even 10 years ago, we were just starting to see a glimpse of what was to come.
Well,
and now it's not even big news anymore. I mean,
it's true. That's true.
Practically every day.
Part of the problem, as you know, I mean, with trying to, first of all, I agree completely that we need to have some sort of national urgency here. And there is somewhat of a bipartisan consensus in Washington and in somewhat in Madison, a little bit, on certain subjects, you know, like decreasing our prison population and whatnot. But they just want to save money. But so there is some consensus, but there's not this hair on fire urgency to that we kind of need.
Well,
but here's the part of the problem, I think, is that you to mandate on a nationwide scale all sorts of reforms is never going to work because of the variations around the country in rural areas, big city areas, racial problems in both those areas, and just the human beings and the political dynamics in various aspects. They're just going to it would be like chaos, I think.
Well, and I also acknowledge that, you know, let's start with the death penalty. It's not unconstitutional. So, I mean, at least the Supreme Court continues to hold as such. So, I mean, that for a starting point is something where you couldn't, you know, we wouldn't want to have the federal government step in and say, hey, Wisconsin, you have to create a death penalty now. You know?
That's a really interesting example, because the death penalty is constitutional right now. But there was a time when it wasn't.
Yeah.
Why? Because 9 people in Washington said so. And then they changed their minds. You know?
And, well, you know, because because they weren't the same 9 people.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's like the 9 people, well, maybe there was there 9 back in the 1850s when they did Dred Scott?
No.
You know,
no,
there was 7? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what the exact number was, but there was a group of men who looked at the Constitution and said, absolutely,
you know,
you're absolutely right to slavery.
Did you know that the Dred Scott decision has never been officially, you know, quote-unquote, reversed?
Well, it was reversed by virtue of the 13th Amendment.
Well,
but
Right. But, I mean, there was never a Supreme Court decision that said, oh, we, you know, never mind, we were totally wrong.
It was so embarrassing that they just wanted to pretend it didn't exist.
Like, oh, yeah, well, that was before the 13th. Okay, now the 13th Amendment's there, so, yeah, that's why.
Yeah.
That's why. But my point is this.
And the 13th Amendment still holds that you can kind of have involuntary servitude as long as they're in jail.
Yes.
So that's one of the reasons that we wanted to increase our prison population back in the 90s and 2000s is that,
license plates and silverware, right?
Absolutely. You know? Well, we're working on the road, too, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean,
too.
Nothing like
that. So, you know, have you ever adopted a highway?
I have not, but I've seen those signs. What do? You go and pick up garbage or something?
You go and pick up garbage. And what you're doing is you're depriving some prisoner an opportunity to work.
See, you're such a do-gooder. You're always looking out for the prisoner's work ethic. That's really, you know, that's so the, Kirk.
Reminds me of a kid in high school. It wasn't me, trust me, but a kid in high school that had this habit of just like, you know, like if he had a bowl of soup or something like that, he'd just dump it on the floor and walk away. And then, a teacher would walk up and say, what are you doing? He's like, if I don't do this, the janitor's going to lose his job, man. So,
genius. I bet you that guy's running a big company right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was one of the Koch brothers. I don't know. But anyway. No, they're older than I am. But anyway, I'm getting to this very protracted point. Doesn't it seem like we could explore some implementation of an expansion of national standards to have a bare minimum set of requirements to ensure that justice is done? Because, my goodness, you see variation. And the biggest fear that we all have.
The ABA has done that. And
well,
they have standards all sorts of things in the justice system.
If you're
system,
in a county in rural Oklahoma where there's a population of 300 people, the ABA standards don't matter.
No.
You know, they just don't. And
because they're going to do things the way we do things, period.
Right. And that's the biggest – that's the number one contributing factor to wrongful convictions is that attitude. We do things around here differently.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we got to wrap it up, I'm afraid. But,
no. All right.
I know.
Well, next week then.
All right, man. Thanks for being on the show again. And thanks, everybody, for listening. This has been Lee LaFence with Kirk and John. Have a great weekend, everybody.
See ya.